Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Farm to Table Talk is the name of this podcast, but even after scores of podcasts on farm to table, I still struggle to define and explain farm to table. Is it just an old way of doing things that's coming back in style? What does it mean to farmers, consumers, restaurants, communicators, and others? Well, when I'm confused today, I usually start with the Google search. But my preference still is to pull a good book off the shelf and dive in. Well, my guests today are offering a solution to this dilemma. They literally wrote the book on farm to table. And my guests are the co-authors of the book, Daryl Benjamin and Lyndon Winkler. Gentlemen, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, to begin with, I'd like you to introduce each other. So maybe we'll start off with, I'm going to start with Lyndon. Lyndon, would you introduce Daryl?
Sure. Daryl Benjamin is a graduate of McGill University in Montreal and has an MFA in writing from the Vermont College of Union Institute and also a certificate in sustainability from the University of Vermont. And Daryl and I worked together for a number of years at New England Culinary Institute, where Daryl taught a number of our sort of general education classes that included some things in the area of critical thinking. So often a lot of his work focused around the areas of sustainable food systems. And Daryl has recently left NECI, but has been teaching in the master's program at Green Mountain College in one of their sustainable food system courses.
Oh, I've heard a lot about Green Mountain College. Daryl, now it's your turn. Introduce Lyndon.
Oh, thank you. And thank you, Lyndon. I hope I can do as good a job. Lyndon is Dean of Faculty at New England Culinary Institute. He is also an excellent chef who is committed to farm-to-table concepts. He has a degree from Middlebury College, and let's see, he's one of the founders of the Vermont Fresh Network here, which is a major force in establishing sustainability throughout the state. He's been with NECI, or the New England Culinary Institute, since 1988, so he's seen a lot of changes and has a great perspective. He was also an excellent person to partner and to co-author this book, and our styles complemented each other and our knowledge systems also. So,
well, I'm going to ask you in a few minutes, I'm going to ask you about this whole process of writing a book with somebody, because I think that's got to be a challenge in itself, although maybe you pull each other along, because I know if I was going to try to tackle writing anything, I would procrastinate, and if I had a partner, it might keep me moving. So we're going to ask you a little bit about how you write a book and how authors who jump into a subject like this, what ended up being the way that you work together. But first, why did you write this book? Why was this something that you two felt like you needed to come together and produce this book?
Okay, this is Lyndon. I'll take that for starters. We had, with all the research that we've been doing on sustainable food systems and incorporating in the classes that we were teaching at NECI, we just realized that there was a lot of great information out there that we wanted to share with other people. And we also, especially from my point of view, as someone who sort of came along in the chefs, the food scene in Vermont from the early 80s onward, I've seen the rise of Vermont as sort of a hub of sustainable food, and farm-to-table has become a really big buzzword where it's almost like a given that if a restaurant opens, it's going to have be farm-to-table. And we wanted to explain why that should be and make sure that it just didn't become a cliche or a buzzword, but that it would be a vibrant movement that, by researching where it came from and why it evolved, we could sort of make a case for why it needs to continue to evolve and grow.
And Roger, if I could say something here, this is Daryl speaking. One thing I found in the classroom while teaching contemporary food systems and the like was that there was no comprehensive book that offered an overview of the issues, historical as well as contemporary overview, how we came to be into this age of industrial food systems. So the way that we conceptualized it was that we would have a primer, basically, a book that hit on the major issues and touched each one and put it into perspective of social, economic, political, and environmental context.
Well, you know, that it's really interesting because one thing that struck me, too, when you both were talking is that, you know, you're in Vermont, and when we're talking about farm-to-table, you're talking about agriculture, I always think in terms of almost like the process of farming itself, in that you have to have good soil to start and plant the seeds and so forth. Mm-hmm. There's something about Vermont that that seems to be ripe for this kind of thinking. You know, when you said it right away, it was occurring. It was occurring to me that if you told somebody that, okay, well, there's this book about farm to table, guess where they lived? Guess where they came from? Of the 50 states, Vermont will be one of the first couple that would come to most people's mind.
Well, certainly, this is Daryl speaking. Certainly, Vermont has established itself at the forefront of many kinds of thoughts, and Bernie Sanders is certainly an exponent of what Vermont is capable of. The state, actually, many people here are open to new ideas and as such have created models such as the Vermont Fresh Network that Lyndon helped establish that are being picked up across the country.
I can't help now that
I think the other piece, too, is sort of, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Sort of a historical piece, too, is that, you know, we have the remnants of the back to land movement of folks that moved to Vermont for a better lifestyle. It's rural enough that it hasn't been overrun by too many chain restaurants or industrial farms. And Vermonters are independent enough that they're willing to look at different ideas, even if it may not match their political philosophy to begin with.
Well, and you did produce Bernie Sanders, and a large number of people across the country were attracted to his ideas. I'd be curious to find out how many of those people were also find themselves in the farm-to-table movement, whether they were, you know, I should be hesitant to bring up politics, but nonetheless,
well, it's an excellent point, Roger, because when I left NECI, I went to Florida to work for 5 months on the book, and I told people who were interested what I was doing, and they had no idea what I was talking about. Farm to Table, is that a movie? I got as a response, or, you know, people just, they didn't know about it. And I think that that really represents the majority of people across the country. They are unaware of the issues,
ironically,
political issues and otherwise.
Yeah, you know, but it's ironic because I'm sure what you're saying is true. But you know, Lyndon, you probably noticed this story that came out from the Tampa Bay Times this last year that was saying that, in fact, the number of restaurants, and they were particularly talking, and she was talking about Florida and Tampa in particular, that were claiming farm-to-table because they thought that we'd get more people into the restaurant, but many of them she found were making false claims, and they really didn't have a farm connection, and that became... actually, I did a podcast with her, and it's one of the most popular podcasts I've ever done, where the people
It's called greenwashing, when you falsely advertise green concepts in order to garner marketing share. So you're, you know, giving the appearance that you are farm to table, when in actuality you are not. And yes, I read many articles on the subject, and some investigative journalist broke the story that these were just regular industrial foods. Sure.
Yeah, and I think, and that's also a real reason why the book is so important, because we want to talk about, you know, really what's behind that buzzword. What does it mean to be farm to table, so that people will look for that and recognize it and support it, rather than just going along with a catchphrase that sounds good.
You know, and I would imagine that in the culinary schools, everybody's kind of drawn towards this direction. What really fascinates me, too, about Farm to Table is it has become a brand, but it wasn't created by some, you know, large company or small companies. Or I mean, it's spontaneously evolved almost as a as a brand. And it doesn't have a caretaker, doesn't have somebody, you know, some company that's investing in and positioning the brand, per se, but people are drawn to it. They go in different iterations. I mean, there's farm to fork, there's farm to this and farm to that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree, and that's the great thing about it. That shows the universal recognition of the value of farm to table, and so that's why we see, you know, states as different as Louisiana and Oregon and Hawaii passing farm-to-school legislation in the last year that sort of supported purchasing more local foods to get them in their food systems, that that people, and while, you know, while we do have a strong recognition of Vermont of farm-to-table, there are also many people around the country that are doing great work, and we try to highlight that in the book and not be too Vermont-centric or even U.S.-centric. We even talk about the Rome, Italy food service system, because they're serving organic and local food there, having evolved from a very industrialized food system before that, when what was in the schools.
Yeah, and if I can just add to that, in fact, I think there is a caretaker for the farm-to-table phrase, and that is like-minded people across the country that have a name or a concept to hold on to in order to gravitate their nonprofits towards. For example, it's a way of unifying the grassroots movements into legislative action, into activism. So I see that the caretakers are the people themselves, or those people who are passionate about sustainable food systems.
It's interesting, too, that it all starts with farm. I mean, maybe that's the obvious, and that's a good place for us to start, too, start with farm. But, you know, all these phrases are like farm to fork, farm to plate, farm to table, farm to school. What am I leaving out? There's got to be some more farm to somewhere else.
Farm to institution.
And you know, again, without anybody setting the rules and say, okay, we should all start with farm. I mean, that's part of the whole phrase and reference, and appropriately so. And where else are you going to start but with the farm?
Well, the book is divided into two parts. And the first part is farm, which, although we contributed heavily to each other's, that was my principal area, and Lyndon being chef, his was table. And yes, historically, if you look, you know, just looking at the concept of agriculture, it all comes from soil, and soil is the most important part. So there are many components, but they all are traceable to the farm. And in the last 100 years, we've seen radical changes to how food is farmed, and the great majority of people are unaware how food is produced and how it ends up in the supermarkets.
I can't help but try to confuse matters a little bit, because there's also part of that movement right now is growing without soil, too. I mean, there's...
Oh, yeah. Well, that actually... Sure.
Yeah, so there was actually a big debate in Vermont recently about hydroponics and whether that should be considered organic or not. We have a local farmer, Dave Hartshorn, who has Green Mountain Harvest Hydroponics, and he's basically using organic methods, but he can't call it organic because it's hydroponic. And the consensus of this gathering of many people was that they wanted to keep it, that organic would be associated with soil, so that there could be a real clear definition. But there are certainly people that are doing hydroponic with organic-like methods, But then there are also many that are doing it with lots of chemicals as well.
Sure. Well, we've had a podcast here recently with somebody from the MIT, actually Caleb Harper from MIT, and they're working on projects like this. And he's been involved even with Target that might, you know, grow lettuce in the stores and, you know, greens and things like that. It is interesting. It's something for people to wrestle with. And Linda, when you were saying about the controversy of people wanting to be sure that soil was staying part of it, I mean, that, you know, that's so much is still being worked out, because even the definition of organic is a little bit vague about the sustainability practices. So it's much more specific when it comes to, you know, pesticide and herbicide uses and so forth. But
yeah,
but
this is Daryl speaking.
Yeah.
And I agree with you, Roger. It's actually, people are even confused at the level of the difference between organic and local. And so you can be local without being organic, and you can be organic without being local. They are not mutually interchangeable terms.
Well,
but
every big farmer I know is getting into organic too. If they were traditionally conventional, they're starting to move towards having some organic, if not completely going to organic.
I can only hope that's because of the demand that's being put on the big agri companies by the public.
It is all demand. I think it's not that it's not that they believe that their other system was unsafe, because they're quite proud of the way they were producing, but they see that's fine. If that's what people want, then we're going to respond to the market.
Exactly, which is why you see some organic products now at Walmart, such as Stonyfield yogurt, which is industrially produced organics.
When we get into industrial produced, let's go back to the first half of the book now. Could you give us a sense of the scale, of the breadth and depth of the kind of topics and the kind of farming that you explain especially in the first half of your book?
Yes. The first half of the book identifies the food systems that are in this country, which pretty much are one food system, which is called the industrial food system. And if you compare that to organics and local food, I'm sorry to say that it's just a rounding error.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that it's almost 90, it's over 97% industrial in this country, and it's just negligible organics or alternate food sources. Mm-hmm. So when you go to the supermarket, you're looking at heavily processed foods in general.
Well, the only thing I'd ask you about that, though, I mean, industrial can also, there used to be a positive word for that. I mean, when we were an individual, we could say we were industrious because you kind of work hard. I mean, it's high on his...
You're absolutely right, Roger. Yeah, I apologize for not being clear. When I say industrial, I mean factory. When I talk about factory, I'm talking about scientifically calculated efficiencies that increase short-term profits, and this can be done on a mass scale more. In the 70s, the U.S. government, with Earl Butz at the helm of the Agriculture Division, told farmers, get big or get out, and that's what we have today. We have huge, huge farms with very few products, actually. There's corn, there's soy, there are a few more, and they're industrially produced, which means that they have a lot of inputs that are chemical, for example, or counter the nature of, if they're doing a CAFO, which is a confined animal feedlot, counter the nature of the animals that are on those confined animal feedlots. They are fed food that causes them to get sick, then the farmers, so-called farmers, have to give them antibiotics. The antibiotics end up in us. And, of course, it's well known that we are becoming more, humans are becoming more resistant to antibiotics, and part of the reason is that we're ingesting them so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I had to say about back even to the Earl Butts age, because when I was really young, he was making those speeches, and actually I was on a program with him when I was just right out of college, and you know, the farmers I know are so stubborn that they wouldn't do anything just because Earl Butts told them to do it. They're more likely to say, oh, forget that. He's just a big bureaucrat. But having grown up on a farm in that time, there was no choice. I mean, you weren't making enough money, and you couldn't afford to get, you couldn't get labor, and you had to get bigger equipment, and you had to get, or you could not pay the bills. I mean, and certainly through the 80s, people were going broke left and right. And it wasn't that they didn't know how to grow carrots. I mean, it was that they needed a certain level of scale or they couldn't survive.
Right, right. And, of course, they were supported by subsidies from the government.
True. That's true. That's true. There's only those row crops. So let's go back into the farming side. Now, of all types of farming, it's pretty easy for people, I think, to understand local. Maybe they understand organic. But there's terms now like permaculture and integrated pest management and agroecology. I mean, talk about branding issues. I mean, these are pretty hard for people to understand.
Yeah, and those are all concepts that we talk about in our Beyond Monoculture chapter, where we're talking about what are the alternatives to the industrial food system. And what all of those have in common is that they're sort of following the rhythms of nature. And so while there may be some differences in how they're rolled out, there's a lot of common ground between the way they view the farm as an integrated system that in the more independent it can be from extensive external inputs, the better it's off, you know, so that we have things like raising vegetables and animals in the same land so that they can be a benefit to each other instead of a detriment, you know, instead of having a tremendous amount of manure from a CAFO that needs to be disposed of and could cause pollution in rivers and things like that. It's a more sustainable amount of manure that's spread on the fields and used in a way that helps the system. So we do talk about things like, you know, organic certification and biointensive farming and permaculture. And I think the great thing about permaculture is that it's a restorative system, that's something that's really needed when we have these systems that have been depleted. We need to have a system for restoring both the culture and the agriculture that will help restore the land to its peak.
But isn't it a little confusing, though, to say, for example, if you're involved in training chefs, and now this kind of helps us transition to some talk on the second half of the book in particular, so the table side of it, and if you're involved in training chefs and they're getting their restaurants going, I mean, how much do consumers want to know and understand about whether or not the production system was agroecology or whether it was permaculture or, you know, integrated pest management?
Well, if I can answer that, on page 55 of the book, we have back-to-back explanations of permaculture and agroecology. And if you will permit me, I'll just read a sentence or two from each. Permaculture is a term coined by Australians Bill Mollison and David Holmgren in the mid-70s to represent a combination of permanent agriculture and permanent culture. It's a design system that seeks to mimic the patterns and relationships in nature in order to provide food, energy, shelter, and other material and non-material needs in a sustainable way. Agroecology is similar to permaculture. Agroecology has emerged as a discipline that follows ecological principles to study, design, and manage ecosystems that are both productive and conserve natural resources and that are also culturally sensitive, socially just, and economically viable. So when I took my course in leadership in sustainable food systems at the University of Vermont, one thing that the agroecological professors did was go to foreign countries and instead of bully them around and saying, this is what you got to do, And, you know, in order to be sustainable, they actually did most of their, spent a lot of time listening, just listening to the natives, to the people who lived there, getting to know what the problems were before they even formulated a response. And when they did it very subtly and gently in a supportive and integrative nature.
Yeah, you know, I'm living in near Santa Cruz, California, and UC Santa Cruz is really out in front. And in fact, Steve Gleisman, who I think may have coined the phrase years ago on agroecology, wrote the first book on it for sure, and he was here at UC Santa Cruz. You know, it's fascinating, but it's hard to argue with. But again, I think if I go back now, how do you talk about that to consumers?
Well, Roger, that's really key. I think, how do you talk about any of this with consumers when there are so many variables, not to mention vocabulary words that people might be unfamiliar with? Mm-hmm. I wish there was a single answer, a silver bullet, but there isn't. My approach is education. Mm-hmm. I think the more people know about it, the more things will change or swing in the direction that we want them to go in, which is a healthier direction.
Yeah, and I would agree. This is Lyndon. And I think a lot of it has to, whatever system that there is farming or people are buying from, we look for certain things in terms of it being sustainable, and I think that's the bottom line: is it good for the land? Is it good for the local economy? Is it good for the workers that are working on the farm? And then it's a system that we want to support. And one of the points we make is it's not all or nothing. We can't immediately go to totally organic or totally permaculture or anything, but every step we can take to support, that local farmer. I was just at a very small farmer's market in Waitsfield a few weeks ago where there were two farmers there, and so I made a point to buy something from each of them just because I really appreciated the fact that they came out on a winter night to put out their product. And when we think about the effect on the local economy in terms of the multiplier effect of the dollars spent in the local economy and staying there to support the local systems, and one of the things we talk a little bit about is that a lot of people sort of make fun of the locavore movement because it was kind of trendy and people were saying, oh, we're going to eat local in such a radius. But what it did do was it sort of pointed out the gaps in the food system, what the infrastructure was missing. Mm-hmm. So we had, people in Vermont were all of a sudden looking for a source for a sustainably produced vegetable oil. And so someone in the Northeast Kingdom started pressing sunflower oil and a business was born and supported by that movement. And then when you get groups like colleges that are spurred on by their students asking, where's your food coming from and is it sustainable, then you get, large institutions supporting, some of the growers that wouldn't be able to maybe market directly to the public that are sort of in that medium realm where they're not quite big enough for commodity food, but they're too big to sell directly at a farmer's market. If we can establish a market for those sustainable mid-sized producers, we're doing a lot to kind of promote that the perpetuation of a sustainable food system.
Well, I'm going to come back on that.
Yeah.
I do want to add, though, here I am in California. We grow, 300, mm-hmm. nearly 400 crops, and almonds and citrus and so forth. You're probably not going to compete with us in Vermont. So there's going to be some mm-hmm. food products that you're going to have to be getting from areas that can have the climate that can mm-hmm. can deal with them. But again, I want to switch a few minutes now over to the chef's side of looking at it. Do you envision that it will continue, that chefs, the people that you've been involved in helping train, restaurants and school service and so forth, will take terms like maybe agroecology or permaculture and incorporate those into the menu, just as now they may be saying that they've got a farm-to-table menu and sourcing and so forth? Do you think this is going to continue, that they'll find ways to describe these different kind of systems and integrate that into their purchasing plans?
It's an interesting question because on the one hand, we don't want to be too preachy with our menus and our food, but on the other hand, we do want to support these sustainable systems. So I think having the conversation and talking about where the food comes from is really important. and doing things like farmer dinners where you get to meet the local farmer that produced the food. But I think that, chefs do have a sort of a responsibility to play an educational role, but at the same time, we've got to balance that out with not being, not hitting people over the head with it.
Well, you gentlemen just done a wonderful job on this book, and we'll plug it again. I'm sure people can find it on Amazon, because I just looked at the description on Amazon not long ago, and it's very good. And I don't know of any other books that are in this category. But what was your normal routine to actually produce words?
Yeah, for me, it was to get up at 5:30 and run for an hour, because if you're sitting as much as I was sitting, it's not healthy. And then I would go to the Blue Door Cafe on the Treasure Coast and just drink coffee and work there all day, or go to Starbucks in the morning and then have lunch, and then go to a library for the rest of the day and work in a library. And, putting in 8 to 10 hours a day for 5 months straight, including weekends.
You didn't eat lunch at Starbucks, did you?
No, because I detest the food there.
Yeah, coffee's good, but, I thought so. Well, we won't ask about that restaurant, but I love that kind of approach. So how did you approach it, Lyndon?
Fairly similar. I'm most effective early in the morning, so I would get up around 5 or 5:30 and work for, a couple 3 hours before I went to work, and then periodically I'd take a vacation day and work for much of the day on it. The hardest part was getting it all down to begin with, and then when it came time to revision, that was a lot easier because you had something to start with. The other thing that we did was we shared a lot of resources, so we would sort of set up, Daryl was very helpful in sort of helping me get organized in terms of how to organize my files. And we actually used Flipboard quite a bit. If we found good resources, flip it into a magazine. So if you go to Flipboard, you'll see Farm to Table, Farm to School, Green Restaurant Practices, all of the magazines that we put together that had resources that we were using for the book.
I'm glad I asked that. I mean, I've seen a few people do that on Flipboard before, and I. It's a great app.
What we did was every chapter has its own magazine.
Uh-huh. Wow. Well, that's perfect. Well, I'm glad I asked. That's a good question. This is really interesting. You've done an important service. And I one more comment, too, I'll just make of going through here. I just think you really tried to stay very balanced. I think it's awfully tempting in this subject area to get real preachy.
Say that it wasn't always like that, because I had two chapters on GMOs, and they were deleted by the editor.
We did feel it was important to be as balanced as possible, especially instructors, teaching our students, we want to teach them to think critically and look at both sides of the issue.
Right.
One of the issues that we have sometimes is students will jump on the farm-to-table bandwagon but not really know why. And so I think I always credit, when I went to Middlebury, we had a really good radical education project that sort of taught us about the Vietnam War, and so that was sort of like an extra course for me when I was in college, where we were looking at both sides so we could really understand why we believe what we did. And so we tried to be pretty balanced here as well.
Well, you did a great job. Now, I just want to wrap up, because let's go back to the purpose. You said it was that you want to see this movement survive and grow, and that to do that we need to understand how and why it evolved and how it can be nurtured to reach its full potential. How do you both feel about this movement right now? And I'm going to preface this by saying that there's a lot of attention to the political winds shifting.
Yes.
And say, even sustainability. I mean, now there's more people that are calling into question whether or not climate change is real. And even I just put solar all over my roof, and so I've got solar power in my house. And now I thought, wait a minute, maybe I got ahead of myself here, because now I hear coal is coming back and you don't have to worry about alternative energy. And why won't food be the same sort of thing? Could it not also have a swing back to a more conservative direction, if you will?
My feeling, Roger, is that most people live their lives in a kind of programmed apathy about where their food comes from. I want to disrupt that apathy by action, to action, by educating the public. So I feel the more I'm able to get the word out about why there is a sudden uptick in people with gastric problems, with stomach problems, you know, is that related to the food that we're eating, the untested GMOs and nanoparticles that are in our food right now? I feel like my job is to get out and get the word out so that people can make up their own minds.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's why the book is so important, even more important at this point in time, because we're going to have to kind of resell people on the concept. And I think if we just think about, you know, Duke University estimated that the lifetime health care costs for an obese child is $19,000. So if we're really concerned about health care costs and keeping them down, it makes moral and fiscal sense to invest in farm-to-school and in healthy food. So I think it becomes even more important that people understand why, so that they can counter any disinformation that's out there.
Well, what we're looking for here is a paradigm shift, and there are two ways, essentially, to reach it. You can do it step-by-step increments. There are actually many ways, but the two main ways are step-by-step increments or by catastrophic turn of events. And I feel like prior to the current political realities, it was working what we talked about before, having the term farm-to-table unite and galvanize interest. That was happening little by little. I think we're headed more towards catastrophe. And I don't want to have to say that, because I will continue to work for incremental improvements. But if we ignore these issues, we're going to be in trouble.
I think across agriculture, I see farmers of all sorts of sizes and scale responding and paying more attention to being sustainable than ever, whether or not they have a 100-acre farm or 10,000-acre farm. I know of no areas that aren't trying to be more sustainable. I'm optimistic that they'll continue no matter where politics are, but maybe that's what I just have to say to myself. but I see so many positive examples. And I think the other thing is that we alluded to earlier, big companies, which we've been critical of in the past, are seeing that consumers care, and so they're making it more and more part of their program of explaining where their food's produced, whether it's a small farm or a local farm or a farm somewhere else. They're trying to get those stories out because they know consumers care, so... And I'm sure when people read your book, they end up keeping it on top of mind, too. So I want to thank you both for being on Farm to Table Talk. And I mentioned earlier that they can find your book on Amazon. Is there another shortcut or other places that you would like
Noble.
To have them go?
Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
Yeah. Also available through Chelsea Green. They have online purchasing. And then a lot of independent bookstores are carrying us as well.
Yes.
Well, thank you. I think you two have done a service to people that have got a lot of questions, and you've printed a book on Farm to Table that has a lot of answers. And it's a joy to read. It's a very attractive book. I like the cover, I like the layout, the design, and you cover important issues. So I want to thank Daryl Benjamin and Lyndon Berkler for being
thank
on
you.
The Table Talk.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.